Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Roman Bernard from France. Roman, it's great talking to you.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, we're going to be discussing the terrorist attack in Paris and the whole situation going on in France and Europe as a in Europe. But to start things off, could you please give an introduction to yourself to our audience members who are not familiar with you?
Okay. Some of your audience members will know me through my articles at Radix. Radix Journal, you know, it's the web outlet from National Policy Institute, and I write there as the European editor, and I often appear on the podcast with Richard Spencer, who is directing both Radix and the NPI. And personally, what I am, who I am, is so I used to be a journalist, and then maybe when I turned 26 or 27, I moved on to political communication and marketing, which led me.
Can you say the news outlet you were a journalist with, or would you rather not?
Actually, it has no problem with mentioning them. It was more in the sports media, so but you know, I don't think many people will know about it. But you know, the magazine which awards the Golden Ball in soccer, as you say, every year. For example, I used to write to edit, more precisely, for this magazine, but then, you know, I was not really interested in it, and there were many more things I could do, so that's why I moved on, actually.
At what point in your life did you start to develop the views that you have now?
Of course, it was, you know, a gradual process. You know, you don't turn overnight into another person. But I think what was really the beginning of maybe what could be called an awakening process was when I entered a master's degree in journalism program. And then, you know, the ideology, the degree of ideology that was expected of all students was so blatantly in contradiction to the facts, especially regarding, you know, crime or immigration or even economics or global warming that was topical in 2007. That, you know, I started questioning it, but I didn't really have an answer. I was more in a reactionary fashion at first. And then, so I started a blog in which I was expressing my rejection of, you know, maybe the establishment. It's a common and a very convenient word, but that was about it. And then, you know, by writing, reading, and discussing with other people who had the same concerns, I could really find a more positive goal. Not only what I was rejecting and fighting against, but also what I was standing for. And of course, that was a more interesting part of the process.
Did you grow up in Paris?
No, I actually I grew up in Lyon, which depending on you know, the geographical scale is the second or third city in France, but you know, there's Paris and the rest in France. Paris, the area is 12 million people, and then it's 10 times less in Lyon and Marseille. So it's really, really different from Paris. So I grew up there, and then I went to study abroad in Ottawa, Ontario. Then I went back to France to another city near Germany, and once my journalism, you know, master's degree was over, I went to Paris which was a natural choice, you know, when you wanted to find a job in the industry. But I know if you add all the years I've spent here, it's no more than 5 years actually. So I don't define myself as a Parisian.
Are there kind of regional rivalries between Parisians and people from other parts of France? I know with Americans, I've never been to France, but Americans sort of like to joke and stereotype about Parisians being snooty.
Oh yes, certainly. You know, since France is centered on Paris, so you have various regional identities, but when it comes to Paris and the rest of the country, Parisians look at all the country as one, actually, and they say La Provence, the province, which in Latin means the place for the vanquished, which is telling, actually. And it's really the way most people who were born in Paris see it. But there's something funny, because in Paris, there's really a huge demographic deficit, and it's only one child per woman. So half the city was born in other regions or abroad, and many people, even foreigners, but also of course people from the rest of the country, become more Parisian than the Parisians when they come here, and they reject their where they come from, and they become more scornful of the rest of the country. And on the other side, of course, there's a rejection of Paris, but it's not really efficient when you don't have a strong regional ethnic identity, like in Brittany, of course, or Corsica. In other regions, it's just, you know, people complaining, but also complaining because they would like to be part of it. So it's less a rivalry than a kind of scorn for the flyover country, as they could say in Paris, and envy and resentment in other parts. And actually, it's quite sad, because Paris is too big relative to the size of the country, and the rest of the country is too deprived of its use, of its fiscal resource, and so it's really bad for the country that it's so concentrated and centered. There are very, very few examples that are similar. Maybe Greece and to some extent Britain, but then in Britain there are several nations, so to speak. But maybe England is very centered on London. But if you look at Italy or Germany, if you're from Munich or from Milan, you don't feel the need to go to Berlin or Rome. You're fine where you are. And of course, in America, it's about the same. You don't have, this centralization pushed to such an extreme that if you want to achieve anything in the country, you have to move there.
Well, we have that in the United States to a degree. But we have different major cities. So New York is finance, Wall Street, the advertising industry. Washington, D.C. is the center of government. L.A. is Hollywood. And the San Francisco Bay Area is the Silicon Valley. And then everything else is like viewed as like flyover country.
Imagine if everything was in one city. And that's really the French situation. Yeah, you have 4 or 5 huge cities that concentrate many things, but then they're divided, and it's not only in a single city. But I guess you wanted me to speak on the recent attacks, and because that was really the heart of Paris that was attacked last time. It's not always easy to understand that, but You know, there are 12 million people in the Paris area, but Paris itself is quite small, actually, for a capital. It's only 2 million people. And so...
In Paris, you have the center of the city, which is very, very wealthy and mostly European, and that's where all the tourists go to, and that's where the terrorist attack took place. And then you have the surrounding suburbs, which are full of immigrants from Africa and the Middle East.
No, it's more complicated because you also have white suburbs like in America. Actually, you have a three-tier city or region, rather. You have a center that is very, very left-leaning, wealthy, and quite mostly white. Then you have a second tier, so the near suburb, which is mostly immigrant, and poor is not really the word, because we are not sure of, you know, the sources of revenue of many people there. And then you have the equivalent of the white flight suburb in the third tier, where you have a mostly white population, and that is more right-leaning, especially since many of them fled the near suburb. And of course, it's the people who are stuck in the traffic and in the regional trains, and they... You know, they've been red-pilled by the urban experiment, actually. But the place that was really struck by the attack was very central, indeed. And actually, for the time being, I live in this center, and I hope it won't last forever. But when I went back from work on... Friday, the 13th evening, I walked by the Bataclan, so where the concert was attacked, and then I went back home, which is very, very close to one of the six shootings, actually. I'm only four blocks from a restaurant where 19 people were killed, so yes, I was quite close to that, and at the same time, I was, you know, since I was watching a movie when it happened, I didn't hear anything, so it was kind of surreal in a way.
So basically, so you weren't able to hear the actual events, but basically what happened in Paris is like there was martial law and the police shut down the whole city. So were you basically trapped in your apartment, like you couldn't leave, everything was shut down?
No, actually, you know, there's what they say in the media, and then there's what you see, you know, in the streets. Actually, the government said something similar to martial law was established, but I could have gone for a walk, actually, that night. Not, of course, in the very areas that had been attacked, but in the rest, I could have gone for a walk. And the morning after, so only... maybe 10 hours after, I just did that. You know, there's the things you see on TV and in the newspapers, and the things that really happened, and the problem we have in the West is that we rely on national media from our country, and then we learn from the other countries that way. And that's why so many right-wing people in France were enthusiastic about Sarah Palin. And conversely, many people in the alternative right are really admirative of Marine Le Pen, because, you know, since they read in the liberal media in America that she's horrible, they conclude that she's perfect. But things are more balanced and complicated. So back to the attacks, you know, it's so officially there's a France is in a state of emergency, which allows police and law enforcement to break into people's houses and seize weapons and drugs and things like that.
That happened, like with 9/11. They used the attack by Islamic terrorists as a excuse, but basically they can crack down on the civil liberties of their own citizens. And it's sort of similar to what you see in Germany, where the government is confiscating property to give to refugees.
Oh yeah. So these things definitely happen. But then, you know, the president announced on the evening of the attacks that the borders will be closed. And of course, many people have tried, just to walk through the border with Italy or Germany or Switzerland or Belgium, it's very different from North America situation. And the borders were not closed at all. So one of the teachings of the aftermath of these attacks is that you really have to check what happens on the ground. And on the ground, you see that there was even an MP, a French MP of the right, who said, okay, I will check myself if the border is securely closed, and he managed to pass through an AK-47, so a Kalashnikov rifle, assault rifle, and that's to tell you how loosely the border is controlled. And of course, it's very ironic that they make such a claim that they are going to close the border when they've just opened it to the migrants, the so-called migrants.
Can you talk about the psychological process you personally went through when the attacks happened, when you first found out about it?
Oh, it's a very good question, because I went through several stages, actually. My first reaction, actually I mentioned it with Richard Spencer, is I couldn't help but crack jokes and dirty ones or dark ones, and it was just a way to blow some steam off, and then I became more serious and angry, actually mad in a way, the Howard Beale way. And after a while, maybe 12 hours, the third stage was almost, hopeful and confident, because I think the reaction of the, the general public was quite positive. There were no excuses like there was for Charlie Hebdo shootings, and people were starting to mention the enemy, not only terrorists without mentioning who is doing that. So that was the third stage, and now I'm a bit the stage I'm now is more now I hope that people are not going to forget again, because when you look at the past years, for example, in 2012, in March, in southwestern France, there was, I think, close to 10 people were murdered by Muslim terrorists. And I'm sure I could go on the street with a camera and ask people when it happened. I'm not sure they would remember the months. I'm sure they wouldn't, but even the year. And I'm sure maybe I would get only 50% of correct answers on the identity of the killer. So that was almost 4 years ago, and many people have forgotten. So now I'm in my more maybe balanced state of mind. I think the reaction was positive, but I fear that it won't last. So, in a way, the job of people like us in France and in other parts of the Western world is to, not to keep people angry, because that's not positive on the long term, but to keep people maybe aware or awake of the problem and of the solutions. So,
You personally know any of the victims?
No, not personally, but I know people who knew people who died. So you know, it's you know, always the illustration of the fact that many people are connected, and you have only I think in the United States an experiment was made, and everyone was related through 6 degrees to every other one, every other person. So yes, I know at least 2 persons who knew people who died. And actually, you know, when I went back home from work, and when I walked by this concert facility, I saw many people in line, and because the concert was about to start maybe 1 hour later. And among these people, I saw people who died. I didn't know them personally, but you know, it's strange. And the place where one of the shootings happened, so the place that is closest to the place where I live, I used to go there a few years ago. So yes, it's a place I know quite well, actually.
From a symbolic standpoint, what they were attacking, Charlie Hebdo, they were attacking the newspaper because they were printing articles offensive to Islam. In the case of 9/11, you could make an argument that the Pentagon symbolized American military power and the World Trade Center symbolized American economic dominance. From a symbolic standpoint, what were they directly attacking?
Oh, clearly, quite clearly, they were attacking white people. And you know, first, the facility. It's really a concert, place where, mostly the audience is white, young and white. And then, the band that was playing, so there's metal in the name of the band, but it's not metal, it's more rock, actually. But even rock is mostly listened to by white people, young white people. So that's the second point. And then one of the witnesses of the attack, you know, he said to the media that he was about to be shot down, but since he was slightly swarthy, one of the shooters said, "Okay, no, you're Muslim, so I'm not gonna shoot you," and he shot another guy right next to him. So, you know, it's quite clear who they were attacking, and they were aware of that. The other thing is that, so you have, of course, the concert facility, but then you have 4 restaurants or bars that were attacked. And it's really, it's almost a cliche of Parisian life. You know, people having drinks and dinner sometimes until 2 or 3 in the morning on Friday and Saturday night. And of course, again, it's mostly and predominantly white people who do that. And another symbol that was attacked, of course, is a stadium. You know, the Saint-Denis Stadium, where actually France won in 1998 the Soccer World Cup. And it's quite a symbolic place, actually. And Richard Spencer noticed that it's actually very close to a scene from The Dark Knight Rises, when Bane storms the stadium in a football match. Actually, the scene was very similar. The only difference is that this time they didn't manage to enter the stadium. And so that's why there were quotation marks needed. Only 3 people who died at the stadium, and not maybe 500. Because if they had managed to hide into the public, it could have been a real carnage, actually.
I know with football in Europe, or as Americans would say, soccer, is there a sort of nationalist element? I know in Poland right now there is, but in France that the French soccer team has traditionally been mostly of immigrant origin. Is there still sort of a nationalist element?
Actually, yes, there's a civic nationalist element, and football or soccer, as Americans say, is really central to the propaganda of the French civic state. And in 98, again, when France won the World Cup, you know, the propaganda of the regime was that it was one third black, one third white, and one third Arab team. When actually it was only it was two third white, one third black, and only one player was Arabic. But the propaganda was there, and of course, propaganda on the long run is more important than mere facts, as we see with history, because it's what people remember. They remember propaganda more than history, more than actual facts. And so, if we consider that the French state has a kind of nationalism, and I think it has, it's just civic nationalism in opposition to ethnic nationalism, yes, the football team is very central to that, and actually, sports that were for a long time very white, like rugby, now they've been diversified, and they're starting to put the civic propaganda into that. And of course, as you mentioned, in Eastern Europe, it's very different, because in Poland, which is a good example, it's more ethnic nationalism indeed. And if you look at what Polish hooligans are doing, it's very different. But I'd say, you know, with civic nationalism, what is funny is that you have, so obviously the state is doing its own, it's following its own agenda, and it involves so promoting minorities, etc. But people who are truly nationalistic from a European point of view are going to support the team anyway. And we see that, of course, in America, with the football teams, American football teams on campuses. We see that in England. We see that with, for example, you know, soccer clubs owned by Israeli billionaires or Arab billionaires and supported by mostly white fans. And you of course also have that in France and in Paris, especially because the big team here in soccer is owned by Qatar. And
they're hosting the next World Cup, which actually the irony is Qatar is a country that is largely responsible for financing, yes, jihadis in Syria, and they're also the ones financing these horrific mosques that are going up all over Europe.
Exactly, and actually, just after the Charlie Hebdo shooting, so last winter, Paris went to play away from Paris, in, you know, against another team. And the hooligans had a huge banner saying Qatar funds the Paris team and terrorism. And of course it was almost a diplomatic incident, actually, because the emir was very mad at that. And since he managed to buy off, you know, left-wing and right-wing parties alike, the establishment was very quick to denounce that, but the argument held because it was true. And it's probable that people are going to do that again.
One thing that's interesting about Qatar is their major media source is Al Jazeera, and Al Jazeera puts out a lot of sort of propaganda, like about white guilt and the same kind of stuff you get from the Western media. And I mean, those societies are, Qatar is basically like a slave society. They have an explicit caste system where they have people there from Africa and South Asia who are basically treated by basically treated like slaves. But I think mm-hmm. what it has to do with is the elites of those countries, they go to Western universities to study, then they sort of adopt that propaganda. So a country like Qatar kind of combines the worst aspects of Arabic culture with the worst aspects of like American culture.
Oh, and you could mention another Near Eastern state actually, which is not Muslim. Israel is similar to that, and actually if you look at the history of former colonial empires, indeed most of their leaders went to British or American or French university, and when they went home, they imported the worst of the West, and they defended at home the worst of their countries, and that gave us many corrupt politicians in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, of course. And yeah, that's what they are doing today, and it's very efficient because since they speak half our language, by language I mean symbols and values, it's very efficient for them to strike us. You know, if you take Bin Laden was very westernized, he spoke English fluently, and he was very well educated. And it's much more efficient to do that than to have, some leader from the mountain of Afghanistan. It doesn't work. They need westernized elites that throw back at us the ideas that we taught us. And in a way, it's a kind of punishment for the West.
And obviously, I mean, I think the Syrian conflict is important because it ties in with a lot of this refugee crisis. But it's interesting if you look, as I said, Qatar combines kind of the worst aspects of Arab culture and Western culture. What's fascinating if you look at, like, the Assad regime, basically that region, like Syria and Lebanon, they have a long history of being colonized by the Greeks and the Romans and later the French. So someone like Assad and Syria has much more, as far as Middle Eastern countries go, they're much closer to the West because of their history than Saudi Arabia.
If you look at Assad and his wife, it's not only cultural, it's also ethnic. I mean, Assad could pass as Italian very easily. His wife looks like totally European, and I think it has been, testified by genetic studies. It's, you know, apart from the questions of gas and oil resources, which of course are very important, and the fact that they want to have a pipeline that goes through Syria, and they just want to dismantle the country for that. It's very hard for me to understand why they suddenly hate Assad, because, you know, in 2008, Nicolas Sarkozy was then France's president. He started the Union for the Mediterranean. The first session of it was in 2008 in Paris, and Assad and Gaddafi were invited, and actually Gaddafi was invited like a hero, and he went back a little later, maybe in 2009, and he could plant his tent in the presidential garden, and 2 years later he was dead, mostly because of Sarkozy. And with Assad, it's the same. He was welcome as a friend, and then he was almost overthrown, were it not for Russia.
And the French, if you look at history, the French government is supporting the rebels. But I was reading somewhere that under French colonialism in Syria and Lebanon, both the two groups that were most supportive of the French were the Maronites in Lebanon and the Alawites in Syria.
Yeah, because they were the most educated minorities, and the French decided to rely on them to administer the country, which was sensible. And it worked, I think, quite well, especially in Lebanon, actually, maybe more than in Syria. And Lebanon is really a town country now, but in the westernized part, it's I've never been there, but many people in my family have, and they told me that it was still, these areas are still very nice because they gave the power to these minorities. So yeah, you're right. When it was working well, they were helping the right minorities, and now they're helping the rebels who are just tools of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. But of course, it's also related to the fact that Syria and the Hezbollah in Lebanon are allies of Iran, and then it goes back to the whole strategy of the Middle East. But just a note in passing, you said, and it's true, that these attacks in Paris are related to the Syrian crisis, and at first it was not sure, but then we discovered that two of the eight shooters were refugees, and other ones managed to escape the controls, the border controls, by going with the flow of refugees. So of course it's a direct consequence of that, and we can all thank Merkel for that, because it only took 3 months.
One of them was a refugee. The other one was Belgium-born of Moroccan origin.
Mm-hmm. Actually, all were of Arabic origin, obviously. But the media, and that's a problem with, civic identity. It's very efficient when people are, they identify with abstract identities like French or even worse, Belgian. That they just had to say, oh, this guy was a Belgian and the other guy was a Frenchman, and of course people are not buying it, but the media they're really doing their utmost to hide the perpetrator's real identity, and they're going to do that again until people are not listening at all, and it will take time, actually.
After the attacks, has there been sort of an upsurge in nationalist sentiment and support for Marine Le Pen? I mean, do you think she has a strong chance of being the next prime minister?
A prime minister, it's impossible, because to be prime minister, you have to be nominated by the president, and have a majority at the National Assembly. But what's possible is that she gets elected in 2017, which I'm not sure she will. I don't think she will, actually, but it's almost certain now that she will make it to the second round, as her father did in 2002. And then most probably either Sarkozy or Hollande will defeat her, because there will be a kind of union against her, as there was actually when everybody elected Jacques Chirac in 2002. Regarding the relation to the attacks, we don't know yet, because of course there have been very, very few polls since the attacks. It's a very special context because next month there are regional elections, and Marine Le Pen should win the northern region, and her niece Marion Le Pen should win the southern region. And maybe in two or three other regions, it will be very, very hard for the left and the mainstream right to avoid another National Front victory. But, you know, nothing is sure yet, because it's quite possible that the socialists and the mainstream right are going to combine their forces against what they see as the main threat. And it's really the one of the teachings of these attacks is that when you have Muslim terrorists killing 130 people in Paris, eventually it's the so-called far right that is blamed for it. And it has been the case after Charlie Hebdo, and this time there are many people in the establishment who say that it's because of racism and discrimination. So it's very hard to know if there's going to be a kind of nationalist uprising soon, but one thing is certain is that the government is really working full capacity to prevent it. And just an anecdote in passing, a very prominent politician on the so-called right suggested that all Christmas decorations are forbidden because it's because of religion that these attacks happened. So you see, they want to forbid a Christian celebration because a Muslim attack happened. And they're really going to do that for a while, actually.
Do you see the core of the issue as an issue of ethnic displacement, or do you see Islam as a religion, as a threat, or both equally?
Islam is a very convenient banner for many Eastern and African and Arab and Asian peoples. So, of course, there's an ethnic component, but there's also a religious component. The question remains, because many people are talking about coming civil war, but to do a war, you need two sides. Otherwise, it's just a takeover. And for now, there's only one side, or maybe there's three sides, and two are allied, and the other one is repressed. And of course, the repressed side would be the normal Europeans, and then there's a combined front with the West establishment and the people coming from mass immigration. It's really hard to see how things will change, but I don't think, you know, nothing goes up to the sky, and I don't think that Islam will dominate the world forever. I don't buy that. So at some point, there will be maybe a blowback, and my position on the matter is that it can only happen with a European counter-strike, and not relying on failed national identities, which are quite useless now, because as a reporter said, all the perpetrators were, or most of them were, French or Belgian, with quotation marks.
The same hostility from non-Muslim immigrant groups like non-Muslim Africans or people coming in from like the French colonies in the Caribbean?
We have to sort the problems out. There's hostility coming from them, and also maybe economic hostility from the Chinese, but that's something in California and in New York and in Canada for that matter. But it's something more, maybe easier to handle, because the figures are not the same, and it's more a question of ethnic competitions and world views, And when worldviews are completely different, it becomes really an existential threat, which, so I, it's a problem, and if there wasn't the Muslim issue, I think it would be something to be addressed. But, you know, when you look at the situation, it's really not a priority, because it's true that you have non-Muslim Africans, but those coming to Europe are maybe, I don't have the figures, but they are mostly Muslims, maybe 80%. And the Chinese are numerous, but not as many as in North America.
Michel Houellebecq has a book called Submission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fictional novel, but it's based on a scenario which I believe he thinks is likely. So right now, you have an alliance between the immigrant Muslim underclass and the French elites. His mm-hmm. scenario in the book is that the Islamists will actually take power, get over the elites. Do you see that scenario as possible in the future?
Oh, if nothing changes, it will happen. The timing is not likely, because he predicted that for 2022, which I don't think could happen, just because of numbers. But as I told you, maybe you know, for the question before, the establishment, the real threat they see to their power is the National Front ascendancy. And so they are going to do their utmost to stop that, including by allying themselves even more with Muslims. So yeah, it's a likely scenario, and it's really what you're seeing now. I mean, you have when there are by-elections, for example, and a candidate from the National Front makes it to the second round, the two other main parties are going to ally against it. So why wouldn't they support, as it's, you know, in the novel, they eventually support the Muslim Brotherhood. Why wouldn't they? Because it's really their default mode. Every time there's a National Front candidate, they are going to vote against it. So yeah, it's quite likely, but maybe not for 2022, maybe for 2032.
But I think there really is a real danger of European countries becoming majority Muslim. I was reading somewhere that Lebanon 100 years ago was like 70% Christian, and now it's about 30% Christian. So that's an example of a country that in a relatively short period of time went from being majority Christian to majority Muslim.
Which country again?
Lebanon.
Oh, Lebanon. Yeah, it's, of course, people fleeing this country have been, you know, it's played a huge role, because Christians have disappeared. There are many, many examples like that, and sometimes in places very few people care about. But if you look at Nigeria or Ivory Coast or Côte d'Ivoire, Senegal, many places in Western Africa, or even in Central Africa, like Congo, Christians are really being displaced, actually, for demographic and military reasons, and political ones, of course. In Sudan, I mean, of course. And in the Near East, it's very similar. In Europe, so there's the immigration and then natural, you know, demographics playing. But if you look at religious figures, there's also the fact that more and more Christians don't practice, so it makes the numbers drop.
I mean, that's an issue. It's also, that's an issue of religion. I mean, if you look at California, where I live, California was, I was born in 1985, so at that time, California was maybe about 65 to 70% white, and now it's down to less than 40%. So that's a dramatic change in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. If you look at the projections for America. I think it's in 2042 that it will be 50-50 between whites and other minorities. And then if nothing changes in 2060, that Hispanics would become the majority. Yeah, these projections are frightening, and of course if nothing changes, it's what will happen, but not only because I think there will be a resistance at some point, but also because there's no, you don't have unlimited growth, and at some point things are going to recede. The only question is at whose benefit, and if Europeans worldwide don't do anything, it won't be at their benefit. That's the real question here, in my opinion.
I was reading, as far as like a birth rate statistics go, and France has one of the highest birth rates in Europe at about 2.1 children per woman. Mm-hmm. Is that driven primarily by Islam, or do ethnic French women have a higher birth rate than other European women?
It's both. Actually, it's mostly driven by African and Muslim immigration. But then, I think even among white women, French white women have more children than other European white women. But of course, it's not sufficient, because so with 2.1 children, we're just at replacement level. But then if you look at maybe among white women in France, it's something like 1.7, which is not sufficient. And as we know, demographics proceed with staggering speed, actually, especially if immigration continues. So I wouldn't bet on the future of France as a nation. For me, it's over, and it was a painful realization I made when I was maybe 26, and then I concluded that I have to accept the idea that France is over, and it went for a long time. I don't want to keep only the image of a country in diapers. And maybe now I want to focus on Europe and the sake of Europe. And when I say Europe, it's Europeans worldwide. That's what interests me today, because that's where I think things are still quite possible now. But for France as a nation, I don't think there's hope. And you know, it's not hopeless that to say that there's not hope for France. It's just to recognize that France, you know, made its time, and now it's time to move on.
So what could probably happen in Europe is that some countries like France, England, Holland, and Sweden could fall. But you're not 100% pessimistic. You think some European countries could end up surviving, especially countries like Hungary.
I'm not speaking of countries, actually. I mean, I don't place my hope in Hungary or Poland. I place my hope in Europeans. And I think that today we don't have anything resembling a solution. So we have to, of course, to create it, and first to think it's true. And that's why what we are trying to do on paper, and of course when we speak, and to propose a real alternative. But I really don't think that, things are going to go awry, and I'm going to flee to Hungary and then it will be fine, because if France falls, and if Germany falls, if Britain falls, I don't see Hungary thriving in the middle of chaos.
France has nukes, so that would be very dangerous for Islamists to take over with French nuclear weapons.
Yeah, that's a frightening thought, but I guess, things are always more balanced, and that's why Welbeck's scenario is quite likely, because it doesn't describe a France run by Al-Qaeda. It's more a kind of compromise between various forces. So you have the Muslim Brotherhood in submission, in Welbeck's submission, but you also have classical liberal right-wing people who think that it's better if companies and businesses are more free, and the left is is glad with the fact that there are more social benefits in a way. So it's a kind of awkward coalition that the Muslim party does in this novel. And so I don't think that tomorrow we are going to have Bin Laden's ghost toying with French nuclear weapons. Maybe the same scenario could happen
in the short term, but that could be a long-term scenario.
It's always possible, but then we always have to consider the fact that other forces are going to arise to take these weapons, and it's not going to be a one-sided game. Actually, as far as nuclear nukes are concerned, Muslims are really, really far from them. And it's just that nukes are not very useful in the war against terrorism. And of course, if terrorists manage to completely overthrow a regime, they could seize these weapons. But before they do that, I think the last remnants of the French army would ship them to America or some other place. I don't think that tomorrow it's likely that you have an election, and then the new Islamist president goes into the nukes room and throws them all at Israel or some other country.
That's what happened in South Africa when the ANC took power. The old white government in South Africa shut down their nuclear program.
Oh, yeah, and I was also thinking about Pakistan, who has nukes, and so far these nukes have been safe. I don't know for how long, and maybe it could happen, but then you have forces, and you have intelligence, you have forces on the ground, and you have people who are going to react against it. So I like to see things in a dialectic way. And even, for example, if you had a Muslim uprising somewhere in Europe, it would strengthen the forces that are resisting it. So the problem now is, Islamization is more a symptom than the cause of the problem. The problem now is that we are no longer a people. We are atomized, and we are unable to build strong families and to have enough children and to pass on our civilization to them. So that's really the problem here. And I think with danger, some of his spirit will come back, not by miracle, but just by, mere necessity of survival.
That's the thing, is the reason Muslims have been successful to organize, and groups like Jews, Muslims, Hindus, they have a very strong social cohesiveness. Western society is totally atomized, and that makes it very difficult for people to come together and accomplish anything.
Yeah, that used to be an asset for Western societies, but when it was implicit that everyone was from the same ethnic and religious background and cultural. But once there is diversity, of course, it's in my piece for Radix, I used the image of billiards balls, because it's really what it is. You know, where there's no triangle around them. You just need a white, or in that case, a black ball to scatter them all over the, you know, the board. And once you have the triangle, which would be nationalism or religion or a combination of both, then it's much harder to scatter them away. And you have that also with very small minorities sometimes. Asian minorities, you have huge numbers in North America, but in many places in Europe, there are not that many, but they are going to control many shops and places and joints just because they are cohesive, as you said, and you know they are going to loan money to each other so they can buy restaurants. And that's really what we need today. And that frightens me much more than Islam, I have to say.
As far as the different regions of go, what parts of France has the strongest nationalist sentiment? I know, obviously, I mean, I don't think Paris probably doesn't, but I was reading that Marine Le Pen is pulling well in former socialist strongholds in, like, working class parts of northern France.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in southern France there's a city in the Riviera that's very, it's actually a wealthy resort town, I forget the name, but they have a Front National mayor named David Rachline.
It's Fréjus, it's on the Riviera, and it's quite, yes, many right-wing and rich people. The National Front has two different electorates, and it's very hard for them to combine it, and the only solution is, of course, to make economic issues go to the second or third rank in the priorities, because what is going to unite people is not economics, it's going to be national survival, and then you can unite these people. So as you said, the National Front is doing very well in post-industrial regions in the northeast, where you used to have coal, steel, the automobile industry, the train industry, all these things. So people were voting communist until the 80s. And now they are voting for the National Front because they want kind of a, we could say, social nationalism. And in the south, and also in the west, people are going to vote for them more because they are conservative. So it's very different. The only common ingredient is that they don't want to be displaced.
Very fascinating in France, how you do have wealthy people who are still loyal to the country. I don't see that at all in the United States, but what is interesting is we have Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is the Republican front runner, mm-hmm. but he's actually appealing to a lot of working class voters who have traditionally voted Democrat, like people in the Rust Belt.
Yeah, and he's doing it quite well, actually. He's doing, of course, he's much wealthier than Jean-Marie Le Pen was, but he's doing what Le Pen was doing in the 80s, appealing both to the conservative bourgeoisie and to the working class. And no, I'm not a Democrat, but if I were, that's really what I would advocate. It's you don't have to, as the GOP is doing or the mainstream right in Europe, to divide people on economics. It's really suicidal. You have to unite them on what is really existential. So it's not money, it's identity and faith and destiny. That's what is going to unite people, to make them come together. And then you can deal with economics. But really,
yeah.
What Trump is doing is excellent, because he says, okay, there are wealthy people who vote for me, there are poor people who vote for me, but what matters is that we are a nation. And even so if it's issue not true, yeah,
is preserving the nation, national sovereignty, and opposing dispossession. All these other issues like taxes, abortion, gay marriage, they can all be left, ideally, like, I think they should be left up to the local levels.
Oh yeah, I agree, and actually it would work quite well, because you have, so more and more the countries are polarized and atomized, so you could have nationalist regions with gays and mass abortions, and then other more conservative or Christian regions. It would work. Actually, it already works. If you look at the United States, the two coasts and the flyover country, it's you know, it's hard to see a nation again, but at least with Trump, something very essential is bringing people together. More in the Midwest and the South, of course, and on the coasts, but even still, you have very different situations in the Midwest and the South, and he's speaking to both. And actually, it's what Marine Le Pen is trying to do. But maybe I will sound a little bit pro-American here, but I think Trump is doing it better than Marine Le Pen.
Okay, so Roman Bernard, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.